Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with New Books in Russian Studies, and I'm here with Professor Margaret Peacock to talk with her about her book, Innocent Weapons, which is about the role that children played in Cold War era propaganda. So anyway, thanks for being with us, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if you would start us off by telling us a bit about yourself, where you went to school, how you got interested in Cold War history in general, and this topic in particular.
Okay. Well, first, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you today. I actually did my PhD at the University of Texas in Austin. I studied under Joan Neuberger, who is a scholar who these days works on film, but wrote a really brilliant first book on the history of hooliganism in 19th century Russia. And I very much wanted to work in children's history, particularly in Soviet or Russian Soviet children's history. So she was definitely my target advisor. I fell in love with Russian history and particularly with this material as a child. I think I was probably the last generation to actually do nuclear drills as a child in school growing up. You know, I grew up in Alabama, where in the 1980s, we still, you know, every once in a while would hide under the desk because there was a nuclear bomb coming. And I think people sort of forget that the 1980s was a period of heightened nuclear fear. These are the years when The Day After, you know, filmed on ABC television on a weeknight. And you had a massive anti-nuclear movement, you know, sort of resuscitated in the 1980s with the collapse of detente and the rise of Cold War antagonisms with Reagan. And my parents were very much involved in the anti-nuclear movement. So, you know, as, you know, would suit me, I guess, I, instead of being terrified of the Russian threat, became deeply fascinated by it and decided to go off and learn Russian and study Russian history and become a Russian historian. So that's how I headed in that direction. I actually initially thought I would go to grad school to study what happened to the children who were left behind when the kulaks were all sent off to Siberia in the 1930s under Stalin. And got about a year into that research before realizing that if I continued to do it, I was going to become suicidal because it was so dark and so depressing. And the material was just impossible to navigate, especially since I myself was like had a family and had children, and it just wasn't going to work. I was not a nice person to be around. So I quit it and decided I was going to go to the happier, more comforting years after Stalin dies in the 1950s. To the Khrushchev era, where there's at least an inkling of hope and a resurgence of creative output, and to focus a little bit more on the Cold War so that I could think more comparatively about the Soviet and American Cold War experiences.
Now, your comment there reminds me of reading the introduction to Lifton's book on Nazi doctors, where yes. He talks about his topic having almost ruined his marriage.
Yes.
So,
totally. Yeah, you know, I remember in grad school,
hazard.
Totally. I remember in grad school, we, it was weird, but noticeable that the German and the modern German and Soviet historians all hung out together. And we eventually realize it's because we're all manic depressives.
I get that. Yeah, maybe I've escaped it by being a 19th century scholar myself, but before the mass murders start.
Yeah.
Which maybe we should, I interviewed David Hoffman for his book about the Stalin era last week. Maybe we should ask him how he survives it.
Oh, he's got to be, he has to have a dark soul to do what he does. There's no question about it. What's great, though, is that at least Soviet historians and Imperial Russianists, too, because, you know, Russia is just a history of suffering, you know, think very deep and morose thoughts all the time, but also have an ability to really let go and have a good time and enjoy themselves.
Mechanism.
Yeah, something like that. So I always have the best. I always have the best time at the Russian conferences. You know, far better than any of the others that I go to.
Huh. About your book, then, I was wondering if you could tell everybody what about this Cold War consensus that the Americans and the Russians are both trying to build, and what role the children play in that.
Okay. Well, this term Cold War consensus probably needs a little unpacking. It wasn't actually mine initially. There are other historians who have talked a lot over the years, you know, big famous people like Noam Chomsky, and then, you know, lesser known but equally important historians like Wendy Wall, who've talked about how the United States, at least Chomsky in particular, is talking about the United States, but really how governments, modern governments in the 20th century, worked very hard, and particularly in the Cold War, to figure out how to construct domestic support for international policies that could otherwise fail to elicit support. You know, the Cold War was not a war that had any obvious ending. We call it a Cold War. We call it a war, but it was a complicated event that lasted for 70 years. That, I mean, really, depending on who you talk to, some people trace the beginnings of the Cold War back to the 19th century. But point being that because by the time we get to 1949, because each side had nuclear weapons pointing at each other, there was no real possibility for a conventional resolution to the Cold War. There never was. At no point were American and Soviet soldiers ever going to line up, you know, for a great battle, like a great Napoleonic battle, and decide a winner or a loser. Instead, this was going to be a war that was going to last potentially for generations, where there was going to be no clear winner, but there might be potential for victories in proxy wars, a la Vietnam, a la Afghanistan, a la India and Iran, Guatemala and Iraq. And, you know, the list goes on and on. But none of those smaller wars would ever actually resolve the larger war, the larger Cold War that was continuously shaping the globe. So these governments, both the Soviet, what I at least made the argument in the book was that these governments, both the Soviet and the U.S. governments, had to figure out from the 1950s on how to convince their domestic populations that these wars were worth fighting for, and that they were worth the vast expense that they were going to cause, and they were worth the population. You know, the cost of this was going to be that one of the costs was going to be that the population had to be willing to hand over to a certain extent its own civil liberties. There had to be an openness to allowing for increased governmental policing and surveillance. There had to be a willingness to go along with the fighting of proxy wars that could be very morally ambiguous, because, you know, the means justified the ends, and the ends were the fighting of communism or capitalism, right? Depending on which side you're on. So that's what the Cold War consensus is, right? It's this effort being orchestrated. I mean, not just by the government, which is a really reified term, you know, used to describe very complex social networks of people who are, for a whole variety of reasons, trying to manipulate and control populations usually for power and profit. And that's exactly what was going on then. So you had these two governments frantically trying to construct Cold War consensus, and they realized actually that there was this tried and tested tool that they could use, dating way back to, you know, Rome in the 11th century, which was the image of the child. You know, children are incredible propaganda tools. They, at least in modern Western society, they have great symbolism, right? The sort of concrete sense. We at least have a sense that they carry this kind of static meaning. They are always innocent. They are when we are facing enemies, they are always the first that we must protect. They are always at risk, and they are always worthy of all sacrifice, of even the greatest sacrifice, the sacrificing of one's life, the sacrificing of one's morals. They're worth everything. So, in the Cold War, Soviet and American propagandists and politicians, you know, went about the business of constructing these really spectacular images of American and Soviet children that they were going to use. They decided, you know, that would get used over the course of many generations to justify policies that would otherwise seem pretty questionable.
I was wondering how children specifically got selected in light of your comment in the book that also the raped woman is kind of a powerful symbol. You know, I was thinking about World War One propaganda, uh-huh, where that comes up, and obviously, you know, Soviet, you know, engaging in mass rapes of German women and uh-huh, after the Second World War. Yeah, any thoughts on that?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Sorry, just why it is that the image of the child got selected for this as opposed to other kind of powerful images that people might have selected to be part of propaganda.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't, you know, because this was a war where soldiers were not lining up, right? There was no battlefield upon which American soldiers fought Russian soldiers. Not only that, but there was no possibility for a Soviet invasion of the United States and vice versa.
Right.
So it wasn't going to work to sort of have images of Soviet soldiers raping American women, because it just wasn't going to be, it's not in the cards, and vice versa. Like, it's just not going to happen. And you couldn't have images of Soviet soldiers bayoneting American children either, which is, you know, sort of the iconic image from the First World War. Like, you couldn't have that either. But what you could have was images of Soviet communist propagandists infiltrating the minds of American children to weaken them, to turn them into robots, to turn them into individuals incapable of independent democratic capitalist thinking, and to make them somehow open to communist infiltration. So unlike in the First World War, the enemy in the Cold War was not, you know, didn't reside on the other side of a geographic boundary. I mean, no question the Russians existed the Soviets existed in the Soviet Union. But, you know, one of the integral defining features of the Cold War, both the Cold War experience, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union, was that you couldn't necessarily know where your enemy lay. This was J. Edgar Hoover's bread and butter. Right, that your neighbor could be a communist and you wouldn't even know it, and you need to become educated and vigilant in order to keep yourself aware of potential communist activities, so that you can protect yourself and your wife and your children, because the enemy doesn't reside on the battlefield anymore. The enemy resides, you know, on the playground or in the classroom, you know, as the case may be. So that's, wow, you know, there's a big difference between. There's sort of a difference in image, but not a difference in kind, I guess, between how the United States, I mean, about how the propaganda works in the Second World, I mean, after the Second World War and during the Cold War, than how it potentially works in the First.
Excuse me. So yeah. I was wondering then, in that said, if you could comment on what you mean by the idea of the contained child. That seemed like a fairly important concept of yours.
Right. So I borrowed that language from the policy of containment, right, which was the term that was used to define American Cold War foreign policy, throughout the early years of the Cold War, before we get into the 60s, into rollback, and then later on, into detente. So, but containment was this defining feature, both certainly of American policy, but there was kind of a Soviet equivalent. And what it really meant was that both sides endeavored to pitch an image of their own children as contained in these critical ways, as existing, as kind of tabula rasas, innocent and free of vice when they get started, a la Rousseau, right? Born free of vice. And then the rest of the American community is deeply obliged, and the Soviet community deeply obliged, to participate very heavily in the rearing of these contained children, to make sure that they live the kinds of lives, they learn the kinds of lessons that are going to allow them to become cold warriors when they get older, when they take over the realm, because of course there is no potential end, right? There potentially is no end to the Cold War. The corollary to that, the really critical, important corollary to that, is that they also could be victimized, right? And while they were on the one hand symbolized these crusaders for all that is good and decent about the nation that they represent, right? On the one hand, for the Soviet children, it's all about being followers of Stalin's, at least before he dies in 53. It's all about being, followers of Stalin's lessons and seeing Stalin as the great father, and endeavoring in everything that they do day and night to participate in the construction of a Soviet utopia. At the same time, in American public rhetoric, there's an image of the American child deeply committed to democracy and capitalism and the promotion of freedom at home and abroad, or particularly at home in the 1950s. The stuff abroad happens a little bit later. But point being that right alongside that, and absolutely critical to that, is the idea that this child who is on the one hand crusading for for freedom, and very much symbolizing all that is good and decent in the nation that is rearing them, they are also very deeply threatened by outside forces that demand mobilization by the nation in order to protect them.
I was curious. You mentioned the Boy Scouts quite a bit later in the book, yeah. But you brought them up there in the first chapter. In particular, you were talking about how there were those Cold War related merit badges.
Oh, yeah.
I was just wondering, I mean, do you know, were those things popular? Did a lot of kids in the Boy Scouts, do what you had to do to get those badges?
Yeah, no, they absolutely did. It was getting into the Boy Scout archives was quite possibly the hardest research part of the entire project. You would think getting into the Russian archives would be difficult, but they were a walk in the park compared to the Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts don't want private people doing research in their archives. They're too worried that they're worried that we might do research on homosexuality. So they didn't want to let me in. I had to send a letter explicitly saying I wasn't going to think about his homosexuality when I did my work. And then I think somehow things got better. That, and it's always a good idea to bring a batch of cookies when you show up at an archive.
But, I've never tried that.
Oh, no. Like, lesson number one is, if people are giving you a hard time, go make cookies.
I will remember that. Yeah. Words to live.
Right. No. Yeah. For all of you grad students listening, just find a good cookie recipe. Anyway, but the with the Boy Scout stuff, from what I saw, at least, it looked like it had those badges didn't stay in there for very long. They came into, I can't remember the exact dates now. It was a long time since I did that work, but they came into the Boy Scout catalog, like into the badge catalog, you know, sometime near the end of the, like in the mid to late 60s, and you know, they were gone by the late 70s. They weren't in there anymore. But I saw lots of evidence of Boy Scouts doing them. Interestingly, the Girl Scouts never did. And when I did work in the Girl Scout archives in New York, I discovered that I found all these letters between the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. The Boy Scouts are busy telling the Girl Scouts they need to, you know, they need to have all these badges. They need to do the equivalent for the Girl Scouts. Except that the Girl Scouts, of course, need to learn how to stock the fallout shelters with food, and how to cook an appetizing meal for their husbands inside the fallout shelter. And like that sort of genderized work, labeling was definitely going on at the time. But, the Girl Scouts refused. They had, I think there was a wonderful snarky letter that I found that basically said, we don't see the normalization of nuclear war as a part of our mandate. Thank you very much. And I thought that was really nice.
It's sort of hard to argue with that phrase, the normalization of nuclear war. There's only one right answer to that.
Right. Although, you know, I mean, if you can see in my book that that's exactly what the Boy Scouts were doing, you know, I mean, just what they were doing by, you know, implementing these nuclear knowledge and safety badges, was no different from what Bert the Turtle did, you know, when he sort of told children in a happy, you know, voice that they, if there's a nuclear war that hits while the bombs are going off and they happen to be in the playground of their school, they should just, you know, plop to the ground and put their hands over their heads. I remember seeing that video as a child, and much later, because I grew up in the 80s, but still, and my father turning to me and saying, "Margaret, if you look up in the sky and there's a nuclear war coming, just try to get a Hail Mary out before it comes." Like, try to just get out, like, "Please God, forgive me for my sins." Like, try to get that out before it hits.
that would do as much good as hiding under the desk.
Oh no, it would do more good, because then at least you've protected your eternal soul. You know, at least you've done something, verging on your last rites, so that you've got a chance at making it into heaven.
Right. Reminds me of that great interview with the atomic scientist in the documentary Atomic Cafe, where talking about how people being incinerated in their own fallout shelters and so on.
Yeah. Right. No, I remember that vividly. And I remember, I saw Atomic Cafe, and then I think I saw Das Boot like a few days later. And in forever in my head, I have the thought of men dying in submarines wrapped up in the thought of people dying in fallout shelters or in a tank. Also, going in a tank would suck.
Yeah.
I don't want to do any of those.
Yeah. None of those sound like pleasant ways to go at all.
Probably the nuclear. Really, honestly, if there's a nuclear holocaust coming, you'd do well to just go stand out on the street and enjoy the light show.
Grab a beer and a lawn chair.
Yeah.
In the next chapter, you're kind of focused on the theme of threat, you know, how Americans perceive threats to American children, and the same with the Russians. And you're talking about delinquency and in this country, and then hooliganism in Russia. For a largely English speaking audience here, I was wondering if you could comment on what the Russians took to be hooligan type behavior.
Okay. Well, I mean, hooligan type behavior in the Soviet Union in the 1950s is not all that far off from juvenile delinquent behavior in the United States in the 1950s. I think that, you know, when we think about American juvenile delinquents in the 1950s, we think of Jimmy Dean, right? And we think of the beatniks, and we think of the guys from the West Side Story, from that musical. Like, that's what we sort of, those are our images of hooligans in the 50s. But it's, what ultimately, right, what hooliganism is and what juvenile delinquency is young people failing to follow the paths that have been designated for them, you know, laid out for them by the adults around them, for them to age and grow, and an unwillingness on the part of the young generation to acknowledge and respect the rules of the world that the older generation has created. And whether we are talking about the Soviet Union or the United States, they are, you know, by and large doing the same thing. In the 1950s and 60s, both sides were worrying frantically about the education crises that they perceived were happening. I mean, you have to remember that this is the baby boom. This is the era when schools, public elementary and high schools were actually running two shifts a day because there were so many kids that were being born that they couldn't actually just run a regular school day. So in even mid-sized cities, you'd have one group of kids who would go to school from 7 to 2 and then another kid group of, or 7 to 1. And then another group of kids that would go to school from 1 o'clock to, 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And that was daily, right? That was a daily thing. And that was the only way to manage this vast population. And just like with any other, by the way, that also happened in the Soviet Union. You had a big surge in births happen in the mid 50s and on, right? The early 50s are not so good because the Soviet Union was actually decimated by the Second World War and lots of men are dead. 20 million Russians are dead, right? So it takes a while for them to sort of get the population back up. But even they, get into the business of having babies in the 1950s. And the other big change, the big sociological change that happens in both sides of the Iron Curtain is that they experience a kind of material growth, in wealth and in acquisition that neither side had really known before. For the United States, it was the Great Depression, and then it was the Second World War, and then it was finally the post-war era, right? The Cold War era, where there was real money to be made, and all of a sudden, every family can have a car, and your kids don't necessarily have to go to work, and kids can start at the age of 16, start expecting to get a car. They can have leisure time. They can afford to go to the movies or out to dinner. And the same phenomenon happens in the Soviet Union. And what that means is that you've just got a lot of young people who have a lot more free time on their hands than they've ever had before. And they are trying desperately to figure out what their generation is going to do and how their generation is going to define themselves. Now, my book isn't really about kids, right? My book is about how adults thought about kids and how adults manipulated and used kids and used their images for political purposes. And for the adults who saw all of this happening, this became the failures that they perceived of and that they saw in hooliganism and in juvenile delinquency actually offered all kinds of political opportunities to them. If you've got kids who you are able to label as hooligans, all of a sudden it means that you can start doing major curricular changes to how they get educated because you can do that. You can justify that by saying that the education they're receiving now isn't so good. You can start to argue that the parents are not doing a good job of raising their children. That's why we have all these delinquents. And so we need to start policing the parents too. And we need to start managing far more closely how families are raising their kids. And that means that we all of a sudden can justify getting access to the living room, to the bedroom, to the playroom. We can start calling in experts a la Foucault to somehow, lay judgment on how best one can go about raising a good American child or a good Soviet child. And we can start to, make pretty heavy claims about that. And we can put the power of the government behind it. And we can make parents feel very bad if they aren't following the rules. We can even label parents as communists or as capitalists if they aren't raising children the way that we think they should be raising them. Or we can even just say that they're not raising the children the way we think they are, even if, we don't even know how they're raising their kids. Point being that image of the delinquent child can justify government access to the private sphere in ways that, you really never have seen before.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was wondering along those same lines, it stuck out to me that you said that in both cases, both for the Russians and the Americans, that there was a lot of public worry that the younger generation was succumbing to consumerism. And then I sat back and thought, but wait a minute, both sides say we're better than you because we make more stuff. Look at the material wealth that we make. So how do you square that basic problem that we're better than you because our economy makes more stuff, but then criticize the youth for having a consumerist attitude?
Right. So there are two different notions of good consumption, I guess. There are two different ideas about what good consumption should look like in the United States and the Soviet Union. The United States struggles with this issue because I think there is this inherent paradox in the United States in the 1950s where we, on the one hand, derive great pride from knowing that we are able to make our children happier and more comfortable than anyone else in the world ever has for their children, right? And as soon as you can make the argument that you are able to make your children happier and more comfortable than any other nation ever in history, it's really, that goes a long way in justifying your nation's existence, right? Like, we are the best at raising kids, so that makes us great. At the same time, American jurists, American sociologists, American psychologists in particular, began to really worry that American kids were actually suffering because of this egregious consumerism that they saw. You have to be careful not to sort of say Americans thought anything, because, you know, in the United States, people think all kinds of different things. There is no uniform American thinking. On the one hand, you have businessmen in particular, and producers and manufacturers absolutely making the argument that if you're a good parent, you're going to buy a new pair of shoes for your child every 6 months. Or you're going to buy your child this latest game, or you're going to buy your daughter this pretty new dress, right? That's what defines you as a good parent. Your consumption, your ability to consume, is what makes you a good American. On the other hand, you have concerned sociologists and politicians who are saying, wait a minute, all this consumption is turning our children weak. It's making them, they're not hard like the generation that fought in the Second World War was. They're losing their priorities. All of this consumption that they're doing is going to make it impossible, is going to make their minds weak, and it's going to make them susceptible to communist ideas. Other people make the argument that consumption is a great defense against communism, that if you are consuming, and you're able to consume, then you're not likely to be, attracted to the idea that you should be redistributing your wealth. And there is something to that. Now, on the Russian side, though, there's another thing going on. On the Soviet side, there's another thing going on. The Soviets believed that, at least by the time we get to the 1950s, the idea had already sort of started to grow that consumption was an okay thing, that, that material growth, the ownership of material goods is good because, it's reflective of Soviet modernization, Soviet wealth, Soviet recovery from the devastation of the Second World War. But, and it's a big but, consumption isn't the same. Soviets argue that Soviet consumption is not the same thing as egregious American consumption. It is defined by this term kulturnost, which just means like cultured consumption, that you consume goods in a cultured and mindful way, that when you have a good, when you have something, you know, like a new dress or a pretty shawl or a nice curtain for your house, that you take very good care of it, that it actually, it's almost like it's a piece of art that adds to the quality of your life. And in having it, if you're a working class in particular, and of course, by the time we get to the 1950s, everyone in the Soviet Union is supposed to be working class. If you have it, it is reflective of not just your personal individual rise up, you know, on the wealth ladder, but it's actually reflective of the entire population's rise, right? The entire population is rising in its culturedness. And that's what consumption is. So the Soviets are okay with that kind of consumption. It's when they see kids, you know, wearing blue jeans and smoking cigarettes and getting drunk and, you know, refusing to meet their curfew demands from their parents that, you know, you've got real problems. And both sides are unhappy about that.
That wrapping up the hooliganism point, when I, in the summer of 2003, I lived in Vladimir for a good bit of the summer.
And, oh, I love Vladimir. It's awesome.
And, yeah, it was a fun place. And the lady I lived with had actually been born in Berlin in 1945 in a uh-huh. Russian military hospital. So it was quite wow. a way to come into the world. But anyway, she had all these kittens while I was there, and she referred to them as the hooligans. and one day, she was obsessed with soap operas, as so many people are. Anyway, one day the kittens knocked this vase full of water off and fried her television. And so then the shouts of hooliganism got a lot louder. So I had a chuckle about that when I read your section in there about hooliganism.
So, I had a hazyaika when I was there. I studied there in the 90s as an undergrad, and I was in Petersburg during the White Nights Festival, and I think I probably didn't come home one night, you know, because it's a rockin' party if you've ever been. Like, it's a great party that night, the where you have the longest day of the year up in St. Petersburg. And it was Leningrad then. They were still calling it Leningrad because it was the summer of 1992. And I came back to my Hazyaika's house, and she called me a hooligan. And and I remember my Russian wasn't really good enough at the time to understand that she was being like, she was really cutting me. Like, I thought, oh, a hooligan, like that's just an old fashioned word for adolescent. Yeah. But no, that's not exactly what she meant at the time.
That's a little more serious than that, I guess.
Yeah. I remember apologizing. But
well, that's probably wise. I certainly towed the line where my host was concerned as well. Yeah. So in the next chapter, you spent a good bit of time talking about the Soviet camp, the Artek camp. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that few people in the audience would be familiar with that. We've all, you know, heard what happens at Boy Scout camp and so on. So could you, you know, kind of give us an overview of the Artek camp and
sure.
What's happening there?
So Artek, the pioneer organization was sort of the Soviet equivalent of the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts smashed together, except that basically every child in the Soviet Union was a pioneer. And even in the Eastern Bloc, basically every child growing up in the Soviet era was a member of the pioneer organization. You'd start off actually as an Oktoberist, a little Oktoberist. So you'd actually start with your sort of indoctrination into the party when you were a child, when you were still in grammar school. And then you'd move into the pioneers, and you'd stay in the pioneers until you were in your like early teens. And then you would switch to become, if you had an interest in eventually becoming a member of the Communist Party, you would join the Komsomol. And then from the Komsomol, if you really sort of stood out and you I don't want to say towed the party line, because Komsomol members often were, did really, really important and very good things in their communities. You know, that these were young people who were often quite idealistic, who would take on big service projects. And, you know, if you did that and you also were really good about studying your Marx and your Lenin, then you could get in, you could get invited or have the opportunity to become a member of the party. But that was actually the, that was the primary means for becoming a member of the Communist Party. And the pioneers were this critical part of it, right? Except that every kid was basically a pioneer. And the, they, the pioneers had these summer camps. They were actually all over Russia. There were some in Eastern Europe. There were these pioneer camps, and kids would go over the summers usually, although many of them were open year round, like Artek was. And you'd go for very minimal cost. The state would pay for the vast majority of it. And you'd have these amazing summers. You'd have a wonderful time. You know, the Artek, which was the flagship of the pioneer camps, it's still around. It's right on the Black Sea. And it's this beautiful place where you'd go and learn to, you know, canoe and hike and ride horses and sing songs and do crafts, you know, the standard stuff that you just do when you go to summer camp. You also would do things like visit the nearby soap factory or the nearby, textile factory and meet workers and get some decent communist sort of hands-on education while you were there. So yeah, that's what Artek was. Now, in this chapter, I spent a good chunk of time thinking about how both the Boy Scouts and the pioneers were, first of all, how they were basically all doing the same thing. You know, the Boy Scouts are by and large state subsidized, at least they were back then. They're very much a representative of sort of the ideal cream of the crop young people in the nation. And the same went for the pioneers who went to Artek. I spent some time comparing the Artek experience to the Boy Scout Jamboree experience and seeing how they were very, very similar, particularly in the 1960s in the ways that they promoted the Soviet and American child as an international activist. By the time we get to the 1960s, the image of the contained child, sort of careful, protected, inside the home and the school, that vision kind of gets burst open and it changes into this bigger image of the child as international activist and as defender of either the American or the Soviet dream abroad. And, you know, Norman Rockwell, who was quite possibly the greatest socialist realist painter of all time, you know, did a lot of those paintings. where he sort of painted these pictures of Boy Scouts, you know, leading the way internationally towards freedom, et cetera, et cetera.
I'd never heard Rockwell described that way, but I guess I can see that.
Am I wrong, though? I mean, really, pull up Rockwell and tell me he's not the greatest. Stalin would have loved Norman Rockwell. He would have loved him. And that's not like I'm not dinging Norman Rockwell. He was very, very good at what he did.
Yeah. I was wondering... Just I was looking at the time here, if maybe we ought to make sure and get to the section of your book where you're discussing the how these different narratives collapse.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you when you were talking, there's a section where you're talking about the portrayal of children in Soviet film. And I got to wondering what it was that made Khrushchev permit films like this to begin with. I mean, did he become a prisoner of his own thaw narrative? And so he had to, you know, permit these films to be made, or?
That's a great question. I mean, I think to some extent, yes. Because, you know, there were lots of incredible movies that came out of the Soviet Union in the mid to late 1950s, right? From 56 when the thaw begins, really until 62. And even after 62 and 63, there's some great, really challenging movies that come out of the Soviet Union, but also out of Georgia and out of sort of the periphery of the Soviet Union, that very much challenge the status quo. So yeah, you know, to some extent, I think maybe we could say that Khrushchev became, you know, a prisoner of his own rhetoric. I think he also, to give him the benefit of the doubt, really did believe that reform, like just like Gorbachev did, that reform was going to require a certain amount of openness, and that having dialogue was going to be a critical part of how the Soviet Union got back to being healthy and solvent. So I think Khrushchev believed that there was a need for honest rhetoric. I think that Khrushchev, in some ways, just like Gorbachev, was incapable of seeing how, you know, the system was sick at the core, and that if you allowed, it's the great paradox of reform from above, you know, that if you are the one, you know, implementing reform from the top down, in the end, you know, you start the reforms, but in the end, the people underneath, the people below you who you are giving the reforms to, are going to start demanding that they get to decide what those reforms should be, and are going to start demanding in the end that you have to relinquish your power. I mean, the ultimate reform in an absolute government is that you stop being an absolute government. And so I think that was Khrushchev's problem. I think the other big reason why Khrushchev allowed these films in particular, and the reason why so many movies of the Thaw period have children as protagonists, is because children have this uncanny way of seeming harmless. You know, you can make a movie about a child, and you know, no one's going to see that as being particularly politically incendiary, because children are harmless. And of course, we know that's not the case. We know that they are an incredibly powerful image, right? And an image to be treated very carefully. But at the same time, you know, the standard belief is that children exist in a naive and innocent world that has nothing to do with the world that we adults inhabit. And so, yeah, you can go ahead and make your kids' movie, right? It's not going to do any damage. And of course, that ends up not being the case.
Could you provide folks with an example of, you know, where's an image of children in Soviet movies that the leadership simply thinks goes too far?
So the one that I talk about the most in the book, I mean, there are a few great ones, but the one I talk about the most in the book is Tarkovsky's Ivanovo Detstvo, Ivan's Childhood, which many listeners may have actually seen. And if you haven't, you should, because Tarkovsky's, you know, one of the greatest filmmakers of the 20th century. But, you know, in this film, it's a movie about, no spoilers, but it's a movie about a boy who, in the middle of the Second World War, who has become a scout behind, like who goes behind enemy lines to track, German gun placements and military placements, on the actual front lines. And the boy is, Tarkovsky goes to great lengths, put it this way, to show the extent to which this boy and his future and the future of his generation has been destroyed by war. And the film, and I, when I was in the Russian archives, in the Soviet film archives, you know, really found pretty clear evidence that Tarkovsky and the screenwriter both saw Ivan, this child, as a symbol not just of the lost childhood of the Second World War, but of the lost childhoods that are created when war, you know, when war is something that grips a nation. And the whole film is in many ways a metaphor for the betrayal of adults, the betrayal of children by the adults around them, and the ways that adults are willing to sacrifice the young for their own political interests. There's a lot of them like that. There are movies where we see kids who are hooligans. We see kids who are utterly unmanaged and without any supervision. We see kids who are trying to do good and only encounter drunk and uninterested adults. It was this, you know, I make the argument in this book that despite their best efforts by politicians and public and, you know, propagandists to really control and maintain and manage and utilize this image of this contained child, this innocent and threatened child, despite all of their efforts to do that, the image of the child is unmanageable, and it actually breaks loose and becomes symbolic of the ways in which the system has in fact killed itself, right? The system has broken itself. And the child, you know, by the time we get to the late '60s, of course you have, you know, you have kids, you have young people out marching on the streets saying, you know, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? And the killing of children, the state actually becomes the, you know, the image of the state stops being the protector of the child and starts being the destroyer of the child by the time we get to the late '60s.
Yeah. One of the most fascinating vignettes you have in here, I thought, from the American point of view, was that there's a very tense scene where you have the Women's Strike for Peace group subverting the activities of HUAC. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering maybe just if you could kind of give everybody an overview of what happened when those women brought their children with them and how they those children, just by their mere presence, subverted the whole proceedings. That was quite a story of yours.
Okay. Well, you know, I have to give credit where it's due. The historian Amy Swerdlow also wrote some really great stuff on this story. So, I was not the first person to encounter this narrative. She was, and then, I came across it in the Swarthmore Peace Archives, and, you know, borrowed from her scholarship and not borrowed, but, you know, very much, you know, took careful care to include her work in my retelling of that story. But the, you know, the Women's Strike for Peace was this anti-nuclear movement that was run by women and managed by women, very well-educated college-educated women who eventually they actually become an anti-war group as well. But early on, it's all about anti-nuke. They're very much involved in the protests building up to the big anti-nuclear, like the test ban treaties and stuff that happened in the 60s. And one of the ways that the U.S. government tries to silence them is by calling them up to, you know, during the Red Scare before the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, where they are accused of allowing communists to work within their organization. And the women are told that they're going to be summoned before HUAC, and they debate back and forth how they're going to sort of navigate this really treacherous water when they have the brilliant idea that they're just going to all bring their children with them to the hearing. And, you know, if you've ever been in a room full of screaming 3-year-olds, but it's a thing, and they all do it. They all bring their kids to the HUAC hearing, and it creates utter chaos. It creates, and of course the congressional representatives, you know, can't really do much because here are these women who have right from the beginning been arguing that they are mobile. These are housewives, right? They say, we are just housewives. We are just simple women, simple mothers who are first and foremost concerned for the welfare of our children. And you are the ones who are driving us out into the streets. You are the ones who are forcing us to leave our kitchens, to come out into the streets, to protest on behalf of our children, because you're not thinking about our children anymore. And so they bring their kids to the hearing. And eventually there's a lovely standoff that happens on the witness stand. And the whole thing falls apart, and the Women Strike for Peace are able to go home. Now, that's, I mean, it's a lovely story, but they do end up doing some purging. They do end up, you know, having to be, they refuse to expel any known communists from the group, but they do, you can read in the background literature that they are spooked by this experience. And that it, you know, it, as you can imagine, right, it's a pretty harrowing event for them. So,
you know, as the father of 6 children myself, I'm aware of what a room full of 3-year-olds will accomplish. So,
yeah. Right. You know, if you want chaos, I think that's just how that's done.
It's totally. My house on a daily basis.
It doesn't last forever. I only have 3 of them, and they do eventually stop screaming.
So then on the more on since we're kind of headed towards the Vietnam era here, you spend a good bit of time, you know, on that. There's that famous picture, of course, of the burned girl going down the running down the road, as I recall.
Right.
I was wondering, is there any, this was something you didn't really talk about in the book, is there any similar problems that the Soviet Union experiences as a result of the Afghan War?
There is. You know, I wasn't able, I didn't do the research on this because I didn't pull the book up into the 70s. You know, I just, it, you know, it was just another beast of a project. I also think that the story kind of changes as we move into the 70s. I think that it needed a lot more careful thought and attention on my part to figure out what happens to the image of the child in the 1970s. I don't think it remains static. I think that there are transformations. I just came out with an article in Diplomatic History on Samantha Smith, who was this American girl who traveled to the Soviet Union in the early 80s, before Gorbachev comes to power, when Andropov is in charge, and had to really sit and think carefully about what children symbolize by the time we get to the 80s. I think that it's possible that what I found with the Samantha Smith story would also apply to what I found with the Afghanistan story, which is that, I mean, I'm sorry, the other way around. If I were to look at the Afghanistan story, it would sort of be similar to what I found with the Samantha story, which is that, you know, the Soviet Union had this undying mantra, really from its inception, but certainly from the 1920s on, that it was first and foremost the great defender of peace in the world. You know, the Soviet Union, lover of peace, 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 peace. Like, it's this word that just gets mir, it just gets tossed around all the time. And the Soviets are constantly contrasting their love of peace with, you know, U.S. warmongering, right? This is one of the great Soviet dichotomies of national identity, that the Soviets, you know, are peaceful and that the Americans are warmongers. And we're not going to talk about Hungary in 56. And we're not going to talk about Prague in 68. And we're not going to talk about Afghanistan in 79, right? Like, these are sort of open blind spots. They're big elephants in the room in Soviet rhetoric, and they're not talked about. I think that by the time we get to Afghanistan, the image of the child is so, it has become such a overused image as an emblem of peace that it sort of has lost its meaning. You know how if you say a word over and over again, you eventually stop being able to tell what it means?
Yeah.
It's like that. It's as though you see it so much that you stop seeing it. And the image of the child as this peaceful, you know, the image of the Afghani child, for instance, as this this object worth Soviet defense, right? Worth having Soviet soldiers go and fight to defend. The image of the Soviet child somehow being threatened by Afghan fighters. Like, these that image stops resonating. Like, it just stops working. I think for the vast majority of the Soviet population, and it is, and maybe it does fit with the Vietnam chapter in that it becomes a symbol of betrayal, right? The child becomes an empty symbol, or if it does have meaning, it's a symbol of failed propaganda. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's a tough call to figure out how that would work. A good friend of mine, Sergei Yurchak, has written this great book called Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More, who you should totally interview. And in that book, he makes the argument that that's exactly what we see happening in the Soviet Union in the 1980s, that there's this, that the rhetoric itself, even the performance of the rhetoric, the saying of the rhetoric, the going out and participating in the mass marches, all of it, you know, takes on this empty, this nature. It's just, it becomes an empty performance that if it has any meaning at all, is either lost on those people doing it, or it actually means the opposite of what it's supposed to mean. And yeah, there are great people who've written about the sense of betrayal that comes out of Afghanistan. And if you think about, you know, the great movies that came out of the Afghan war, the great Soviet films or Russian movies and late Soviet movies that came out of that dealt with Afghanistan, often again, right, you see images of children in those films.
So overall here, I think it's pretty fair to say you've uncovered what amounts to the fundamental limits of propaganda, right? At some point it eats its own goal. Is that fair enough?
I don't know. Like you would think, and yet somehow it all also continues to work, right? I mean, the thing that gave me this idea to write this book was in 2003, I was driving home and I heard George W. Bush get on the radio and say that we were going to invade Iraq to defend American children from weapons of mass destruction. And like that he said that, right? And like that worked. And if you turn on the radio, it's, you know, the image of the child as contained and threatened and in need of defense as a justification for otherwise really problematic policies is alive and well. Like that practice is totally alive and well to this day. And our current president does it all the time, badly. It's, you know, it's as though as a population, we just have no institutional memory of the ways in which we are so easily manipulated. Jacques Ellul, the great philosopher, you know, who wrote that seismic book, Propaganda, talked a lot about how populations are always first and foremost waiting for instruction on how to act. And the child works really well in as an instructional tool. And so maybe that's why it keeps getting used.
I guess if it works, you might as well go back to the well.
That's right. If I were a politician, I would. I'd kiss babies all day long.
So we're just about out of time here. Can you give us a brief synopsis of where you're headed next, what your next project is going to be?
Sure. My next book, I just spent the last like 5 years learning Arabic. And the next book is on the history of radio propaganda to the Middle East in the second half of the 20th century. And these days I'm not looking at children. I am still looking at propaganda, and children do pop up because of course they're all over the place. But really this project I've gone off and worked and done work in the Soviet archives, the Russian archives, the US archives, the British archives, the Cuban archives, the Egyptian and Israeli archives. And, I'm really interested in thinking about what dissonance of information, what audio dissonance does to a population when you can change the channel during, you know, the Six-Day War or during the Suez Crisis, change the radio channel and truly hear five completely different versions of what's happening outside your window. And what does it mean to have been living in the post-truth universe, at least since the 1940s? Kind of make the argument the Middle East has been living in a post-truth universe since the 1940s, and that there are some pretty critical lessons to learn from the kind of skepticism of information that we now see in the Middle East as a potential harbinger for what we are soon to face, if we're not facing it already now.
That sounds like quite a project. You should give me a shout when it's done, and we can talk about that one too.
That sounds great. We'll do that.
Okay, thank you very much for being with us, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Aaron. It was great.
You bet. Bye.
Bye-bye.